Welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast. Here, we speak with extraordinary games industry professionals and listen to their story to learn all about what they've built and who they are. GamesNet Berlin Europe is the international games industry initiative of MediaNet Berlin Brandenburg, the networking association for the media, creative and digital industries in Germany's capital region. My name is Simon Oler, and I will be your host for this program. Today, we are speaking with Nate Barker, the founder of Roamer Games, a new mobile game studio in Berlin. And we don't know much about the studio, so we want to find out more. And we do find out more. Nate has a very concrete strategy on how he approaches game making and finding product market fit. And he explains it in great detail, and I don't think you can find that anywhere else. What you can find is a curious piece of information on the Roamer Games website. It says, no douchebags. What might that mean? We also cover topics like why customer service and community management are seriously good entry and also advanced level careers if you want to get into gaming. What you need before you start fundraising and how return on ad spend works in mobile games. So this is an episode where we don't go deep on backstory, creativity or philosophy, the stuff that I'm usually into, but we keep it concrete on career and game making, and we really enjoyed that, and we hope you do too. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy our conversation with Nate Barker.
Hello and welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast. Today's guest is Nathaniel Nate Barker. He recently started his own mobile game studio here in Berlin called Roamer Games. Before this, he spent almost 5 years as director of business development at Colibri Games, also here in Berlin, and before that in Karlsruhe, I think, for a little short amount of time, and has over a decade of experience in gaming and mobile marketing and monetization. I met Nate at a conference here in Germany a few years back and saw him there as a speaker, which made me invite him to my conference at GameOn in Vilnius the following year. Since then, we've been in touch, and I was super interested to hear about his move to funding his own game studio now, starting his own company, and also for doing that, staying in Berlin. That makes him part of a group of expats who have a long-standing history in the games industry, have experience, and are enriching the ecosystem here in Berlin. And bringing some, I think, very interesting cultural differences, especially in how to run a business, which is one of the most important factors, I believe, for Berlin to be pushing to be a next level gaming hub. So, yeah, how are you doing, Nate?
Hello and guten Tag. I feel like I should open that way since I am here in Berlin. I'm doing great. It's been a really exciting 6 months, particularly since I left Colibri to open up my own studio about 6 months ago. So it's been really exciting, but also like really educational in certain ways, just kind of like learning about how all this company building process works from the ground up. But lovely to have some time to talk about it here on the podcast. How are you doing today?
Cool. I'm doing great. Happy to be recording, as always, when a new guest comes on here. Super excited where this will go. Co-host is Simon, as usual. Simon, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you very much. I just started my day with a trigger point massage and feeling pretty relaxed right now. I'm also having some coffee, so that might counteract that. So feeling right in the middle.
Yeah.
Do you have the first question, Florian, or should I start?
Well, I think we'll just start with, like, since Nate is in the process or has started his own company, we want to know how that is going, what is his plan for the company, how much he can share about that, and, like, what's his vision for starting his own game studio?
Sure. We started Roamer Games in February of 2022. And Roamer Games, true to its name, is a studio that intends to visit all sorts of different genres and themes to build the best the best games that we can bring to market. And the objective we have with the studio is that we want to be genre agnostic, audience agnostic, eventually, and really build things that nobody else is focusing on. There's sort of a trend, I think, in mobile gaming where, you know, people will always be chasing after whatever like the next kind of like big thing is. You know, there's a period, especially when I saw this a lot when I was at Colibri Games, where everybody was going after idle games, right? Colibri did it, I think, pretty well. The folks at Hyper Hippo or Kongregate had previously done Adventure Capitalist. All right, that was like the order of operations. First was a venture capitalist, and then Colibri came out. There was some competitors that were making RPG idle games, but we just saw so many idle games. Mm-hmm. And it was the same thing with hyper casual when that started to develop, that there were just so many hyper casual games, and people were sort of chasing after it as the next big thing. And the big thing that we want to do with Roamer Games is to focus on games that aren't necessarily in the center stage of whatever like the new hot popular genres are or the new business models are, but are pioneering new genres, new mashups of genres, and looking to satisfy audiences that maybe are typically overlooked. So that means we're looking at mashups of things that might be a little, you know, a little bit outside of the scope. So something like, you know, a bubble shooter mixed with a progression game or a, you know, decorate game, something like this, mm-hmm. Would be kind of like within the realm of what we're looking at. Currently, we're looking at life simulator games. That's been our focus. So we're really interested in games like The Sims and games like Animal Crossing. Nice. And games that kind of like operate in this sort of millennial or Gen Z fantasy of owning your own business, of crafting your own wares, selling them, being your own boss, but also having your own home and having kind of this like almost like fantasy cottage life that I think a lot of people never really got to experience until, quite frankly, until COVID, when people were suddenly stuck at home and everybody was doing all sorts of like crafting activities. You know, everybody's baking bread or learning to sew or whatnot. Essentially, like that sort of world, and we want to touch on a little bit of that and help people fulfill that fantasy.
Well, I have so many questions. This is a great intro. Like, ooh. Let's get into some specifics on this. Who is we?
Sure. So we are four founders. So it's a friend of mine from the Colibri days. That would be Meadows. He's in charge of all of our art. And along with him, I'm joined by David, who is David Smith, who is somebody who used to work at Wargaming, previously at King as well. And he's in charge of all of the game design. He had his own indie studio, so he's kind of been forged in that sort of scrappy work environment. But having worked at Wargaming, you know, has also seen the flip side, like the larger companies, and how they work and operate. And we also have Ilya, who is our CTO, also former Wargaming, and had worked at another Berlin gaming studio, Treasure Hunt. He was, I think, a director of engineering there. So they are the founding team. So we were joined by a few contractors as well. We have somebody who's helping us out on art, on engineering, and we're super fortunate to also have a business not-so-intern. And I say that because he is a working student, more or less, but is punching above and beyond his weight and helping us in the realm of finance and tax stuff and legal stuff. He's a native German speaker, which really helps me out. And that kind of rounds out our team. Behind us, standing to really support us as a growing company, we also have a number of investors that we're fortunate are joining us with a ton of gaming experience. So we have Play Ventures as our lead investor, huge in a VC in the gaming space, and they bring on a ton of support when it comes to things like company building, when it comes to access to certain products and services at competitive rates, for instance, you know, working with MMPs or with data tools. We also have BLN Capital. So these are the former Colibri guys who left Colibri and started their own VC firm based here in Berlin, if you might have guessed from the name. they're joining us. We have Joachim's Angels. So if you know Elite Game Developers.
Yes.
So his syndicate is joining as well. And finally, we have our advisor, Juha Hanen from Soba, who is joining as an advisor and as an investor. And he's also based in Berlin. So quite a few Berlin, Berlin-based folks that are kind of banding together for this operation.
I gotta say, that's an impressive lineup of people. Especially also on the VC side and like the advisory side, like you guys seem to have prepared this for quite a while.
We are very fortunate to have the love and support of these folks. I think we're benefiting, you know, from just the pedigree of the founders that have joined, you know, just having that logo farm when we were starting of Wargaming, AppLovin in Ilya's case, Treasure Hunt, as well as Colibri, and, you know, some studios that I had worked at previously, like Disney, like that helps just when you're trying to get your foot in the door with the VCs. Mm-hmm. But I've been thinking about, you know, what would be the ways that, I would want to grow a studio for quite a long time. So when we came to the fundraising stage, when we were ready to incorporate, we'd already had a lot of the conversations of like, you know, well, what are the competitors doing that we can outmaneuver around them? And how can we build up a sustainable, successful business model with the least amount of money, with the, you know, most efficiency? Like, we'd kind of been mentally preparing that for a long time. So once we were able to start, we could hit the ground running, and I think investors really like that, and they like the kind of the, you know, curiosity that we approached our studio development with.
Did you say curiosity or furiosity?
I said furiosity.
Okay,
is that not a word? I'm actually looking it up now.
It feels like a mix of furious and curious, which I really like. It's like it felt new in my head, but
I'm looking it up now. Apparently, it is. Oh, it is a word, but it's like a weird word, and it's the quality of being furious. Apparently, it's also a word for insanity in Scots law. So yes, I will say our insanity, our furiosity.
Nice.
I like it. No, yeah. I really like it. Yeah. Okay, so as I interrupted you, you were saying that the VCs and the people that you were looking towards for support were like probably pretty happy, because it feels like you had this Michael Phelps like visualization of how you will move through the swimming pool that is your, you know, upcoming business, or the business world as well, like already visualized very well, you know. That sounds like you did some, you downloaded the code from the Matrix or whatever. That's all the metaphors I have, you know. But it really sounds like that you like really prepped on this, meditated on this before you went in.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that, you know, I had been working on new game strategy a little bit on the Colibri side. So I had a lot of the conversations with what ended up being our investor already, the former Colibri founders. So we were already pretty aligned on just like, okay, this is what a theoretical studio would have to do if they were starting off. This is how you would make new games. And some of that stuff Colibri put into action as well. So a lot of like their new titles that they were testing out are based on a lot of these sort of strategy sessions that we were having. So we got a little bit of practice there to make sure that this was the right way to go about things. And then some of it was, I think, just kind of the magic that was brought in by the other co-founders who had done this, all different sides of the coin, from small to big companies. But all that sort of stuff helps to, I guess, reassure investors that you're going to do the right thing.
Right. And then I guess you already hinted at it, and I guess you can't tell too much about it, but I'll let you be the judge of it. But you kind of said, okay, well, we have kind of these moves planned, how we can outmaneuver the rest. And while it would probably be foolish to tell all your moves on a public-facing medium, you said in the beginning that you want your work to be like genre agnostic, audience agnostic, and something nobody else is doing. And I think that's very interesting. And I was wondering if you could expand on what that really means, because it feels like, you know, a very easy countercultural thing to say, we'll just do what nobody else is doing. But, you know, what does it really mean for you?
Sure. So I can tell you our approach, and it should illuminate a little bit more of the sort of stuff I was talking about. So basically what we do for games that we want to work on is we start off when we're kind of combing through the data, and we look at what are like trending genres and themes. And then we think about ways that we can marry genres and themes that we see that maybe have like a really high monetization potential. So we can look at how much money per title or something like this, but that there aren't too many competitors out there. So if I were just to look at which genres make the most per download, I might be left with something like hardcore strategy games, or I might see for total volume of revenue, something like match threes. Well, hardcore strategy games are extremely expensive to make and take a long time to get out to market. So that's not something that we can do as a small studio. And match threes, on the other hand, where you can just buy code for match threes from the Unity asset store if you want to and adapt that to your own game, there's already millions of them. So it's a red ocean, so to speak. There's too many apps in the market there for you to compete with. So we look at markets where our genres and themes where there are not too many competitors, and where we think we can make a big impact. So that also means that we're excluding things like, say, genres like geolocation AR games. So Pokemon Go competitors. That's a genre where on paper it might look like, oh, there's like only 10 of them, and on average they're making huge amount of money. But in reality, it's really only Pokemon Go that's making money, and there's a few other competitors. But it's so driven by that one IP that we can't compete there. So we find our little niche instead. And we find a little niche that we think we can compete on and we think we can develop quickly. And so then we just start building a prototype that we think satisfy, well, actually first, to step back, we run ads that kind of confirm our hypothesis. Are people interested in this title? Are they interested in the idea of the title? So we'll make video ads that look and feel like the game that we want to make. We run them on Facebook. We use a company called Geek Lab, which helps us to create fake App Store landing pages. So users will see like this ad on Facebook for, say, like, like a bubble shooter or something. They'll say like, oh, I want to play a bubble shooter. It looks great. They click on the bubble shooter ad. They end up on a Geek Lab page. It looks like a normal App Store landing page. Then when they click to install, they're presented with, a survey that says like, oh, sorry, this game isn't out yet, but can we collect a little information to see what you like about this title? And we're collecting data along the way so that we can compare which ads are generating the most traffic, which generate the most installs, and what the user responses are once they work their way through this sort of simulated funnel. From there, we can pick our winners and we start developing prototypes. And then at the prototype stage, we look at first what is fun to us, then what is fun to friends and family and people in the industry. Then we look at what is fun for people on services, like maybe players via services like Playtest Cloud or other playtest distribution services, to see what are the user responses to the games that we produced. Now, the trick with that, of course, is that a lot of those users are already primed to play test games, so they're not really giving you very good quantitative feedback. The quantitative feedback came from the ads that we ran. The next set of quantitative feedback will come from developing the game. But on user tests in the very beginning, as it is also with tests with your friends and family or industry experts, you're only getting qualitative data. So this is just like, okay, does this make sense? Does this work? Is there more that you want to do? Is this scratching an itch? Is this confusing? Do you want different content? Do you want different mechanics? Yada, yada. And that can kind of like guide a little bit more of your development. So when it comes to how are we like, you know, what are we working on? Sort of what I was talking about really earlier, this idea of these like life simulators and things like that, that can all change. And since we are quite a young studio, this might change in the next, you know, in the next 6 to 8 months as we really hone what the product is, based on some of the user feedback. So we're probably at least a month and a half or 2 months away from getting like real, like, you know, normal human being feedback, not feedback from, from people in the industry, which, you know, it's always going to be like very, very different. And that might end up like adjusting our approach a little bit. But that's kind of like why we want to go in this direction. I mean, there's this tendency. I don't know if you ever watch like, you know, kids, like young kids, playing soccer, football. They all tend to like just run after wherever the ball is. Like nobody like sits there and like waits over, you know, near the goalie box or the offensive line just to get passed to, or make an assist. Like kids don't really think that way. They just see the ball. That's where the ball is. And then they just run towards it. And there's like this tendency, I think, especially in games where you see that happen a lot, where like the big thing comes out, everybody runs over there, but there's tons of opportunities waiting by the goal, as long as you're not offsides. As you can tell, I don't really play that much football, so I'm like really trying hard to make this metaphor work.
I really like that you corrected yourself and went to the European football instead of soccer. I can appreciate that, although we are also agnostic on this podcast when it comes to that.
I'm trying. Sorry.
But yeah, I mean, you also mentioned Playtest Cloud in there, and like I see you're like really tapping into the whole Berlin, let's call it what City Marketing calls it, games capital, like ecosystem. I really love that you are choosing Berlin as your home and as your like place of business, and that you're like incorporating it into your strategy that much. It's really cool, and that you bring all this experience, as I mentioned in the early beginnings. I think companies that have their stuff figured out as much as you do, way ahead of actually going and starting the company, are, as I mentioned, the thing that will definitely like help Berlin get to a next level. And I really see also mentioning the guys from BLN Capital, the former Colibri founders, now investing back into studios here in Berlin. That's stuff that I used to talk about like years ago with people from Finland, Sisu Games, like other people, who, when Germany was always looking, and I guess we are still looking at this, like, how can we catch up, to other markets or to other countries who have their stuff figured out a lot more? And one of the main answers was always, well, we had some people who were super successful, and those people started giving back and investing in small companies, making it possible for them to start out their thing. And obviously not all of them were or are super successful, but it really helps if there's those who made it are reinvesting and also guiding, so it's not dumb money, as you call it. Because they also know what they're investing in and can help guide the companies. So I'm really excited about where this goes and about your approach.
Thank you. It's very nice of you to say that, and it's very validating. And I think, you know, the fact of the matter is that, Berlin has just so much to offer when it comes to support for, well, A, for just like the general startup ecosystem, but particularly for gaming, and has developed so much in the past, you know, 10 years, that it seems like there would be foolish to kind of like head anywhere else, right? You know, I'm like a, I guess you could call myself like an economic refugee from Silicon Valley. So, you know, that's a place where you could see as the industry there was like heating up, and it's still pretty hot, particularly in mobile gaming, you know, maybe about 7-8 years ago. But it basically reached a boiling point that makes it extremely difficult for new entrants and for new studios. So I get to pick on Silicon Valley a little bit, since I grew up there. But that's a place where it is so extremely expensive, to do just about anything, to get housing, to hire people. I mean, it's really difficult to bring people over from other countries, right? The visa process in the US is a nightmare, you know, for extremely qualified folks. To folks who aren't as qualified, but just everybody, it is difficult to get them over to Silicon Valley. So you're like fighting, you know, uphill, all the time there. And I think because gaming is a particularly creative industry, it's not necessarily like, you know, fintech or, some of the other, like, you know, SaaS tech companies that sure require creativity, but not in the same way where you need, you know, artists and designers and people like that. It means that it is really difficult to retain those folks because you need a city that has a lifestyle that they can, you know, really embrace, that has all the creative institutions that they need, that has a community that they can integrate into rather relatively quickly. And that's something that is increasingly difficult in some of like the more traditional gaming capitals that you see around the world, not just in Silicon Valley, but, you know, can be a challenge in, say, London, especially post-Brexit, can be a challenge in Paris, you know, particularly when it comes to the, I would say like pricing, you know, for just the sheer cost of things. But Berlin, on the other hand, offers all of that, all of those types of advantages in spades. The cost of living here isn't so high. There is already a huge art scene, which attracts a lot of creative people. There's definitely government support, which is rare in a lot of other places, significant government support. And now that there's a little bit more infrastructure to help a lot of these, new studios, it's just sort of like a magnet when it comes to attracting, you know, all of these new studios. And the great thing too is that we're at a point where the major studios that did exist previous to this, as people leave, they've started forming their own studios, a bit like you were saying earlier. But yep. They're starting their own studios, and it's kind of fragmenting out. So it means there's actually an ecosystem. So I remember, you know, when I was at Colibri, and you know, a few folks had left to start their own studio. And you know, somebody was asking me like, oh, like, does it bother you? Or like, are you annoyed? Are you frustrated? Are you, that people are leaving? And the answer is no. Like, it's, of course not. Like, you want a system where you have this actual ecosystem where people can yes. leave your studio and they can go and they can start new, new studios or new services or whatever. And then you can kind of support them, that you can either invest in them or you can work with them. You can share information with them. I think that's something that, you know, Finland has had for a really, really long time. And now is, you know, you're really seeing, now this is emerging here in Berlin as well.
Nice. I like that we are so aligned on this, because that means that I apparently know a little bit about what I'm doing, because there's a lot about like a lot of new, actually, I've known you for a while, but since I've moved to Berlin 1.5 years ago, I'm only starting now to meet those kinds of people here. And that's really what is a very motivating factor to me as well. A lot of, expats, a lot of people having worked in the industry for a while, at big studios coming and saying, hey, Florian, do you know, I'm about to start a studio. We need advice on law. We need advice on accounting. Do you have contacts here? I mean, Germany is a little bit complicated in that. We're not going to lie about it. But I really think that since it happens so often, I can estimate or see that it is a trend. And yeah, I think it just pushes the whole place.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Like, there's definitely some challenges in Germany. You know, I think we've all had experiences with just like getting appointments for various pieces of the bureaucracy, or if you're not used to working with notaries, that can be kind of like a complex situation, particularly in our case, just because of the way that we were structured. It's a little bit more complex. But the one thing when it comes to that is that there's like a tremendous amount of like, there's like consistency and regularity. It's like, yeah, it's going to take you, you know, a month to get an appointment at this or that, but you'll get the appointment and it'll be on the day that you set it up, and you're going to know the paperwork that you need. And there's like no surprises. Like, that's just like my general like evaluation of like life in Germany. Like, hey, Nate, how's life in Berlin? I'm like, you know, sure, it's great to have like, you know, great public transit and healthcare and yada yada, but like, no surprises. Like, there are no political surprises. There's like no, you know, it's not like I'm worried there's going to be like a coup suddenly, you know, at the Reichstag or something. Like, no, it's going to be like super regular, super regulated. As an employee, like, that was a huge thing for me when I joined Colibri. It's like, okay, I know that now that I'm hired, like, I'm not going to get just like axed one day, you know, as people aren't, you're not just going to get laid off suddenly. And then you're going to be like, oh God, I'm like living in this other country, you know, and suddenly I don't know what to do. Like, you know, this happens in the States a lot. It's like, you know, regularity, consistency. And it's a huge advantage, I think, particularly if you're building a business.
I think it's really funny. It gives me, you know, Germans like to complain about Germany a lot, right? And some expats do as well, but I feel like you're giving a very good, like a very what's the word, it's like a rectifying narrative. It's like, no, it's actually good. And it's like, oh, thanks, man. Really appreciate that, you know. Many good reasons. That's cool. That's a good vibe. I like that. Yeah, I haven't heard such a good account of like Germany in a while. It's like, okay, thanks, Nate. That's totally, you know, it's easy not to see that. And I think, you know, we hear, let's say, what I know way less about this than you and Florian, but I always have, while I was deeper in the games industry, I felt this fight. It's like, yeah, we need more government support and more funding and da-da-da. And there's like this push, right? But I always like when you sometimes can take a step back and, of course, without the push, you wouldn't get it. So I'm not trashing that, but it's good to take a step back and be like, but now we have government support, you know, and there are very good labor laws. And, you know, let's say a controversial point, maybe the cost of living in Berlin, which you called not so high, which many people here would disagree with, because they've experienced, of course, it rising. But then, well, that's Berlin becoming more of an industry hotspot. It's still much less relative to places like London, New York, or Silicon Valley, right? So it's a good perspective. Thank you for that. And I guess what I was curious about a bit more to the game studios. I mean, I thank you first for explaining your process so in detail. That's super interesting. And then you mentioned the thing that you're most interested in at the moment, and I'm interested in that as well, and that's the millennial cottage life dream. And I guess together with the question of you described your process until where you are now, kind of like, can you talk a little bit about what you envision in millennial cottage life dream games, and also how you envision actually going to market when it's time with a game? because that's kind of where your description of your process stopped. So I'm still curious towards the end of that story.
Yeah, so our games, when it comes to the millennial cottage lifestyle dream, I think there are certain aspects, particularly in that, that make for good game development. For instance, I think a part of that is that users or players want to have a lot of like autonomy over their like space. So they want to be able to customize, and they want to be able to decorate. They want to craft. And that works really well for kind of like the life simulation games. I think they want a lot of autonomy just like over their like day to day. So, you know, you want to be able to run your own business, or choose your relationships, or kind of like have interactions that are maybe more on your own terms. And in certain cases, you know, there's a lot of opportunities also for like UGC, for user generated content that can come out of stuff like that. Obviously this type of mindset doesn't apply to all games and genres. So we are testing actively other genres and themes in case this hypothesis fails and we're incorrect about what the market actually wants. So something like a shoot 'em up, or, you know, flight simulator or something like this, like that's not really going to be a part of this vision. So we'll have to kind of adapt to the other types of audience or genre there. But we're really focused on this. And I think there's other things that come into this. There's a sense of coziness that I think people really want. It's not necessarily like cute, but it's cozy. It's like, oh, this is nice and everything is in its place. And I have, you know, filled up every inch of this with like, you know, things that are designed to like make me happy and make my character happy. And I think that's a big part of it. To answer your other question, so the stages after stuff like Playtest Cloud are basically just running the games, pushing them live. So I know that like back in the day, there was this period. I started my career at Disney Mobile, and when I was at Disney, like Disney had a very traditional approach to media in a way, which is that you don't want to sully your reputation by doing something in a major important market too soon. So if you were going to do a launch, you wanted to do a soft launch first, and you wanted the soft launch to be in smaller markets, like, and you would hear this all the time, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and maybe the Philippines. And there was this mindset for a really long time that any of your soft launches had to be there. And you'll still see this with companies like Supercell or some other like major gaming companies. There is probably a valuable strategy there. There's probably it makes sense for certain types of studios that are really, really brand and image conscious. But for us, being a new studio, like, we don't necessarily have that need to like hide things. So we're just launching straight in major markets, you know, UK, US, probably Germany, France. And then from there, we can just gather data immediately about stuff that's important. Day one retention, day seven retention, ad engagement, you know, ROAS or percent ROAS. Or so that's a return on ad spend, right? So if I spend a dollar to get an install, I want to see how quickly I can get that dollar back. Is it within, you know, if I'm getting 30% by day three, like, that probably looks pretty good, or by day one. But how long does it take me to get 100% of that ROAS back? And then, of course, how long does it take me to get greater than 100%? For really competitive gaming genres like casino, you're looking at 365-day 100% ROAS, meaning it will take you a full year after you acquire a user to earn back the money that you spent to acquire that user. Wow. So those payback windows are insane. And even for some new genres, you know, merge games can be like that, which can be challenging. But so we're looking at, you know, data like that, and based on the data that we get back, then we'll adapt our development process around that.
I want to jump in here quickly because when we are throwing around like abbreviations for stuff, you mentioned ROAS there, which is return on ad spend. Since you are an expert in this, and we usually also have some listeners who are not super deep in each and every topic, can you explain a little bit about, I guess, like the system of how mobile gaming differentiates itself from, let's say, console or PC gaming in that sense? Because like stuff like those abbreviations like ROAS, that comes usually from the mobile games. And it's like, if you are at a conference, you are talking to people who know about that stuff. As let's say a sort of little bit educational podcast, can you explain a little bit about that ecosystem, how that works, like how it differs?
Sure. So gaming has the advantage that there's a certain permanence to the apps on your device. So in order to play most games, unless they're streaming games, if you want to play a game, you have to go to an app store. And from there, you need to install the app, and then you need to open the app on your device. As I mentioned, there's some folks that are doing streaming. Maybe you see on Facebook, you can stream a game, or like, you know, there's some web pages where it's possible. But 99% of games, and certainly 99% of the revenue, is all coming from games that you're installing on your device. So the way that those games get on your device is either you just discover them in the App Store, or a friend recommends them to you, or you see an ad for them. And most of the ads that you're seeing are in other games. So currently the way it works is that, with a few nuances that I don't think we need to get into, currently the way that it works is that if you're in one of those other apps or games, say you're in the Facebook app, in this case, and you're in that app, so that app knows who you are. They know what device you are. They know that you are Florian. And they're like, okay, we got to show Florian an ad, so let's show him an ad for this new Roamer game that's out. So you see this ad, and you click on the ad, and Facebook's like, okay, we saw Florian. Florian clicked on this ad, and then that's all they know. Then Florian goes and he opens up, he goes to the App Store, he installs the app that was being advertised, either on the App Store or the Google Play Store, whichever kind of device he has, opens up that app, and the app says, okay, hi, you're Florian, welcome to the game. And in the background is running a piece of code that is called either an MMP or attribution, but basically there's a piece of code that the app runs that says, okay, this is Florian, this is his ID, and let's see if the reason he is here is because of any other apps or games. So it sends it to essentially like a centralized hub on Apple. That's actually Apple itself, which has introduced this. It's called SK Ad Network. On Google, it is not centralized with Google, but there are third-party services, one of which is based here in Berlin. It's called Adjust. There's also ones called AppsFlyer. And those are MMPs, or mobile measurement partners. There's a few more, but I won't mention them all. And so it says to one of these MMPs, it says, okay, I got a Florian. he installed this game, this Roamer game. Who recently showed him an ad? If it's really simple, it's just Facebook, and Facebook says, I showed him an ad, and so Facebook is going to get compensated for the install. If I said I want to spend $1 for every person who sees my ad and installs it, then Facebook is going to get paid $1 in order to facilitate this install. If there are multiple sources, so maybe you saw the ad in Facebook, but you also saw it in Google, then one of these centralized services is going to say, okay, well, who showed him the ad most recently, and then pay that And then it will pay whoever whichever service showed you the most recent ad. So that's sort of like this attribution side of the equation. On the advertisement side of things, I mean, there's just like a million different ad networks that I can go to at any given time, and I can give them money and they'll get me installs, usually by showing ads in other games. They'll also pay me to show ads in my own games or apps. And I can use that to monetize. And in some cases, I can use that to monetize quite a bit, and use that to support my studio. So I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah, sure. And then ROAS is basically, that's a measurement for you to see how successful you are on like how much you spend on advertising and like at what point it becomes more expensive for you to get installs from that, and like which services work better for you.
Yeah, I mean, there's like an alphabet soup of different acronyms that that are relevant here. So the first being, I guess, CPI, which is the cost per install. Mm-hmm. So if I show one install to somebody and I'm like, I will bid $1 for everybody that installs, my CPI is $1. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'll see that appended with an E in front, an E prefix, and that just means, you know, effective CPI or estimated CPI. And that's more of like a nuanced technical reason, because perhaps you can't actually bid per install, but you can just give an advertising company $100 and maybe they get 100 installs out of that. And then your effective CPI is $1, but you didn't actually pay them per install. You just pay them some other way. The ROAS would be your total spend, and how long it takes to get that back. So if I spend $1,000 and I get that money back within 30 days, and I get all of that back, I have 100% ROAS, 100% return on ad spend. But of course I want to make a little bit more. So I want to get, you know, 110 or 150, depending on the margins that you're looking for. And sometimes people will change that, and they'll use ROAS. You'll see like ROAS used to mean like what is the actual margin, which makes it a little bit more confusing. So somebody will say they want like 30% ROAS, but what they really mean is 130%. Mm-hmm. They want to make all of their money back plus a little bit more. So even among like advertising folks, there's like a bit of like a inconsistency in how some of these are used, which really makes it completely like not confusing, right? If everybody else is calling it,
especially to people who are not in mobile gaming. So I think as an excursus, we don't want to go super deep into it, because obviously there will be people who know all of this, and then there will be people who know none of this, and some in between. So I guess as a broad overview and like as an intro to the topic of ad spend, I think that's a good point to leave it at that. What I was wondering is, you mentioned that obviously, and also from your accent, we can hear you are from the US. You grew up in Silicon Valley. You also moved around quite a bit before you ended up in Berlin. So you are the first US guest here on the podcast, and you grew up in a very interesting time at a very interesting place to our industry and all to all the tech industry. So maybe let's get a little bit into that time in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, so I was born in the state of Illinois, which is I was born right next to Chicago, but I moved out to Silicon Valley when I was about 2 years old. I grew up in a town called San Carlos. So if you're ever flying to San Francisco and you're landing at SFO and you look out the window and you see these like really bright colored, like enormous pools, like out in the bay. So San Francisco is on a bay, and you look out and you see these like bright pink, bright red, bright white, bright green, bright blue, like pools. And you're like, what on earth is that? Those are like algae that are growing, and they're sitting on top of like salt refineries. So there's these, like they bring in, you know, bay water in these like enormous facilities, and they slowly let it evaporate so that only salt is left. And then algae like blooms on those and it turns all sorts of fanciful colors. And right next to those like giant blooming pools of algae is the town I grew up in, San Carlos. So you can wave hello next time you're flying into SF. So I grew up, in kind of like in the middle of like the whole dot-com era. So like I distinctly remember like telling my parents, oh, you should go work for a dot-com, not really understanding like what a dot-com is. But telling them, that it seemed like it was a really cool idea. It's a good thing they didn't, because about the time that I was telling them that, the dot-com bubble crashed. And since all of those companies imploded, I would have been, you know, kicked out of my house if that was the case. So luckily they didn't. They were not in gaming or in tech at the time. And left a little bit for about 4 years. I went to school. I went to film school in New York because – although I liked to play games and I liked to design games, and I even did like a little bit of programming. Like I went to like computer camps and like learned how to like program with like BASIC, and then a little bit later some C++. But you know, as much as you can teach like a middle schooler how to use C++, I didn't really think of like games as like a career. Like I could see like the EA offices from my house. But I still didn't think that this was like a viable career. So I went to video games because it seemed, I went to, film school to make videos, at NYU, which seemed like it was like a good future. Incidentally, so like while I was there, I would like hang out in like some of the back of our like film lectures and then just like play games on my laptop with like this other friend I had in film school. Which seemed at the time like, oh yeah, this is like a good use of time. In retrospect, I'm like, why was I doing that in the middle of these lectures? I guess I was a bit of a bad student. And both of us ended up in games at the, like, you know, years later. So he's a concept artist.
What did you play at the time? Sorry.
We were playing a turn-based, game. We were playing Civ 3, I think, on his laptop. So that worked pretty well in our lectures because we could, alt tab out of it and not lose any progress if we needed to. He ended up being a concept artist for Riot, and then I went into games marketing. But I came back from film school and started working in at Disney. Disney had just bought a studio in Palo Alto called Tapulous, and I had a middle school friend who was like deeply into designing app icons for like just Macintosh computers. Like it was cool to have like a trendy like icon for your hard drive, so that instead of like a little picture of a hard drive or a computer for your Macintosh HD, it was, you know, like a world, like a globe, or it was like a book or a library, you know, whatever kind of thing. And he was like deep into this like world where he was making all of these icons and like selling them. And he parlayed that into a job at this little studio called Tapulous. For those who don't know, Tapulous was one of the first mobile game studios on the App Store. And the way that they started, was actually a bit similar to, in certain ways, I think, to how Roamers started. In that Tapulous, the founders just, when the iPhone was announced, they went out and they bought 30 apps and games, and just a bunch of random apps and games, like completely random. Anything from like, you know, primitive social networks. There was sort of like an app that was like kind of like Instagram before there was Instagram, to one game called Tap Tap Revenge, which was just like it was like a copy of Guitar Hero or Dance Dance Revolution, but like for your phone. So they bought this, and then the App Store launched and they put these apps out. And of all of the 30 apps and games, the two that worked really well was this social media app that worked okay. And this game, this Tap Tap Revenge game, that worked extremely well. And like it worked so well that like Steve Jobs played it like on the stage for one of, you know, one of his events, for one of the Apple events. And so they had this studio and it was like going gangbusters when the iPhone launched. They hired this guy that I knew from like middle school who had been making these icons because they needed like a just like a graphic designer, and he was really talented. His name was Ernest Liu, and they hired him. He's like, "This is cool. I want to get my other friends to work here." So he brought on his friend Robert, who was like a engineering. He like dropped out of college to be like an engineer, went and worked for this company for a while. Who brought in another friend, who then brought in me. So I was like the fourth one of these people. We all went to the same middle school. So like my friend Elliot had like brought me
so
in.
Nice.
And, yeah,
working
like,
with the homies. It's so cool.
It was a bit absurd, you know? So I worked there, and I just worked for them as like a social media, community management, intern. Cause I wasn't a graphic designer, and my coding skills had not yet progressed from, and really still haven't progressed from when I went to like computer camp, you know, 6 years earlier. So, I applied myself by working, in social media and community management, which ended up being like a really, really good introduction to, just how studios worked and how games worked. You see a lot of the process of making a game. And it's like a great place to learn because, and so I like recommend to people who like want to get into gaming, but don't necessarily like know where to start, that, places like QA or, community management are really, really good. They're good places to start a career because you get a lot of exposure, but they're also great places to, you know, grow and continue your career. You know, there's a great career path that is just focusing on community, and community management. I think it's a really essential part of a game studio. So if somebody is interested in that, I'm happy to talk to them about it, but that's where I started.
Yeah. And I want to quickly jump in here because I know that this bit is important to you, and I'll just second that in a way, because when I started working at Twitch, and I was called a localization manager, which was I was like a maid for everything in Germany, right? I was just the German guy. And well, I ended up being the partnerships manager. So that was much more like creator partnerships, which is something that, well, in many ways, I think in the creator economy that exists now, I think Twitch kind of like pioneered a lot of that. I guess YouTube probably did as well, but Twitch was always a bit closer to the creators at scale. But yeah, part of that was also doing customer service, you know, like straight up answering some tickets, which was, if you have to do many other things, that was, for me, that was pretty annoying. But it actually taught me how to work very efficiently in communication. You know, if you go to a good customer service, for example, I recently returned something on Amazon and they're extremely good. It's very scripted, but also very personal. So there's like a really good communicative path here to follow, I think. And then I guess I haven't experienced that, but if you're working on closer to developers, you know, at Twitch, it was more like a people and community thing. I didn't experience, you know, the app being made that much, even though a little bit, because I did like some product posts and blah, blah. But I guess if you actually want to make games and you can like, it's your job to communicate the game development and proceedings, how that's going on to the community and potential customers or people that are already kind of invested, I guess you learn a lot about this process. And I feel like that's also what you're saying, Nate.
Yeah. And we can actually make this a full circle, because the way I started was also like a social media manager, and I had no idea about coding, no idea about graphics, art, whatever. Just started to doing some office work, and like, I needed like content for social media. So I just started like a blog, development blog. And since I didn't know much about games, I just interviewed the guys from the studio and like had them tell me once a week what they were working on, let them explain it a little bit to me so I could write it in the blog, then use it for social media and other stuff. And so from that, I actually learned the basics of game development and how a studio worked while also creating content for our fans. So if you have sort of a like side role at the beginning, maybe where you can like test out and like hone your skills in a way, but also get to learn a lot, I think games are one of the industries, and we had many guests on here who would echo that, to like really get into it without having the specific skills needed for maybe programming or the arts.
And last thing on that, if you want to know about really, really, really good community management, and that goes for the listeners, maybe also a tip for you, Nate, go listen to the episode that we did with Philomena Schwab. She's working on the Wandering Village, the village builder on the back of your giant creature game. And they have like a crazily active Discord. You've never seen it before. So they're doing something right. And she explains some things in that episode. So there's definitely, just like you're explaining very well, your process of starting a company with like a bit ahead of the curve. She kind of explains a lot what goes into really good community management and engagement. And I think there's a lot to learn there.
Oh, this game is beautiful. And oh, there's a Mac OS version. Okay, so I can actually play it. Yeah, I will check that out, as well as listen to her. That's super cool. Yeah, I mean, it kind of shows, right? Because like in conversations with you guys, you sound like you like understand like the different aspects of it, of like the different parts of the development process, which I think is essential, and something that you really get from being in positions where you can touch all of those different roles. Like even if you're just like interviewing people, you know, and you're not doing the thing like you were doing there, Florian, I think that's like a great way to kind of like understand what it is that like people are focused on, what types of problems they're solving. Like I'm not going to pretend like I'm, you know, an expert on like backend engineering, but getting exposed to it and, you know, hearing the types of projects the folks are working on, the types of technology, the types of things that they're trying to achieve with all of like the different tech or tasks that they're up to, gives you a greater sense of, you know, what actually takes to make a game. And kind of like the benefit from being on like the social media or the community management side of things is that you also get a really good sense of like what the players are like, and mm-hmm. what they want and what they are, kind of like how they talk and what their expectations are. You know, it can be a little challenging sometimes because there's always going to be a bit of like toxicity that will seep in from players particularly. And you just kind of have to like learn how to navigate that. But the upsides there are just like enormous. And I think it's a great introduction, to just like how to run a studio. Like you learn, like if you're the person, to put it more concretely, like if you're the person who has to explain to, you know, 100,000 or like a million, like fans, like why this content is coming late or why there was an outage on, you know, last Friday that like completely destroyed everybody's, you know, scores in this event that you're running. Like if you're the person who has to explain it, you start to learn very quick why it actually happened. Mm-hmm. And what were all the moving pieces that failed that caused that thing to happen, you know, and what's the fallout, what's the results, and what are the action points, and learning that sort of stuff. Like this is, I think, critical for being in a game studio. So I worked in, doing that for about a year or so. Then from there, I moved to work at an ad network, called Chartboost, which recently sold to Zynga, for I think about 200 something million, which was super cool. I was like employee number 13 or something there. So while I was there, I mostly focused on working with indie developers. I was just like really enamored with the world of like indie game developers, and I still am. And obviously I'm starting my own studio, so I'm kind of like into that whole thing. And I worked there for a good 4 years and learned the ins and outs of marketing, of monetization, of basically how all the ad networks worked, all the like sort of dark side of of the games industry. Afterwards, I left and I worked for a year in Taiwan, running marketing for a Chinese publisher that had a studio there. Actually, the publisher had two studios there in different locations in Taipei, which is the capital of Taiwan, in two different places. It was a bit weird, but we got to make some cool games. We did like a fashion dress-up game, and we did an Independence Day game. If you remember, like the sequel came out, which was not a great movie, but the game was really cool. I gotta say, which was fun. It was fun to work on some big IP, and then I left that. Did a really brief stint at a company that I had been advising for, which was live ops for charity. So they needed somebody to help out on some BD for a short period. So I helped them. And then, once things were in good shape there, I, moved to Germany to work for Colibri. So lived in Karlsruhe and was part of that rocket ship. So I guess that's like my career where I kind of like bounced back and forth between, studio side, and like games services, and just like moved kind of back and forth, particularly on like the marketing monetization line, which got me a lot of like really good exposure. And I think was part of the reason that when we got funded, we were able to, get such great investors is because we came in with like a full deck of people who, yeah, had done some of the things. Like you'll see this a lot when people are like raising money, like a challenge that they face is that they are lacking one key ingredient. So sometimes it's a bunch of business people, but they don't have an engineer, or it's engineers, but they're doing programmer art or something. And, you know, they need to get an artist. And you'll even see some VCs will still fund those types of studios, but they'll say, okay, we're going to put it into the terms of our funding that, like, you know, if you don't have an engineer, then you have to have an engineer. If you don't have, you know, a business person who understands marketing, you need to bring that person on in, like, you know, the first 6 months or something like this. But we were lucky that we had all of this stuff kind of like to go. That was a bit of a digression, but that's how I got to where I am.
Yeah. I guess my question was, did you always know that you were going to have your own studio one day, or did that idea kind of came up while you were working with the Colibri guys? Or I know some people who had their whole career like framed in their mind as a practice level kind of to then found their own thing. Or how did that come about for you, that entrepreneurial instinct, spirit, and drive that also then, you know, you're obviously doing that very consciously right now. So how did that come about?
When I was younger and I was about to enter into college or university, I knew I wanted to lead an entertainment company. So like my psychology was that I wanted to work in entertainment and I wanted to be on like the creator or like management side. So when I was a student, you know, I made a lot of like student films and I was always like the director producer. When I went to college, I was I minored in producing, which is like the business side of making movies. And so I had that bug that I wanted to be like at that part of the industry. And I very quickly also felt that when I was making games and I sort of came into the game industry, I think I knew that I wanted to have my own studio, when I was maybe year two or three at Sharpoost. So I had done 1 year at Disney, and then I was at Sharpoost, and I'm looking around and I see all these like really successful entrepreneurs, and I'm like, oh, cool. I want to be an entrepreneur. And somebody's like, well, what do you want to do? What's your like entrepreneurial vision? I'm like, I want to run a game studio because it looks like it's a lot of fun. I love video games. I love the industry around it, and I'd love to be in like more of the creative development process. So I knew that then. I wasn't exactly sure how I was going to achieve it. But when I got to Colibri and I met the founders and I saw, you know, how much like awesome work that they had put in and like what their process was and their whole story, I had a little bit more of like a roadmap for how to achieve that dream. And I actually worked with the founders, the Colibri founders, to kind of like figure out what that path would actually be. So they were very supportive. And like, I would ask them like, okay, what are, you know, some things that you think I should work on that would really help me if I started my own studio? And they're like, okay, you know, you should look into, you know, how project management works more. So like study a bit of like, you know, Scrum, or like read this book about, you know, user research, like player research theories, and stuff like, you know, those kind of things, which was also super helpful. So I did actually a bit like what Florian was talking about when he was, talking about like interviewing other people in the company. Like I did the same thing almost. I interviewed like all of the different positions. I interviewed people who were game designers, artists, engineers, to try and get a sense of like what their day was like, what their workflow was like. We actually published some of those interviews as, we had a podcast, at Colibri. So I did some of those live on the air. So if you're not sick of my voice yet, some of those are also up on the Colibri Games podcast. So it's the same thing, right? It's like, you just got to learn what everybody else is working on. And that's kind of what I focused on doing. So I had a idea of what I was up to before I left to start my own studio.
Yeah, very good. Very good. Yeah. I'm always curious about that. What the influences are for that. But I have one question that I was curious about since I first read about your studio. I guess, and maybe we can kind of bring it back to the beginning here as well, because you described your team in a lot of detail. You didn't really say what you were doing. And well, I think we have some intimations of that, because you are, I feel, and you can correct me on that, the producer, right? What a producer is for a movie, the orchestrator, the funder, a vision giver, and so on. And you can describe that more. And there's the thing that, you know, there's not much to find out about Romer Games online yet, except for, well, a few details, maybe this podcast. And one of the things it says is no douchebags, you know, and I've read this before somewhere. And well, I'm really curious about that, what that means to you, and why do we advertise with that? And can we, well, what I think it means, please explain, but can we be truthful to that, and so on and so on? So what is no douchebags? What does that really mean?
Sure. So I guess to like rewind it a little bit and answer your question before we dive into the douchebags. Yeah, I mean, I'm working on all manner of different things at Romer. So we have a game designer, and we have an engineer, and we have an artist. So those kind of like core components are locked, which is great. So some of the creative choices in all of those directions are being taken by like this incredible team of experts. And I think it's really the CEO's role to support all of those folks and make sure that their jobs are as easy as possible. So I work on finance topics to make sure everybody's getting paid. I work on legal topics to make sure that we're not getting sued or fined. I work on marketing and monetization related things, since I have like really direct experience there. And then anything else that's like random that comes up, I'll work on. So if the game designer says, hey, I need a list of, you know, all of the most common professions, you know, in G20 countries, so that we can like develop, you know, different professions for the simulation game. Okay, I'll do that. Or if the you know, CTO says, hey, I need a new engineer, can you help me do some recruiting? So I'll do HR and recruiting. So it's like a lot of like these sort of like random grab bag of things. Like every day for me is different, versus I'll talk to my CTO and like every day for him, he describes as like Groundhog's Day. You know, he gets up, he makes some coffee, and he sits in and he starts coding. And I'm like, are you okay with that? Is that all right? He's like, yeah, it's great. It's great for him. He just wants a lot of consistency. My day is the opposite. It is a completely random set of things. We did develop a core set of values for our studio. And I think for us, since we are new, it's really important that we start to develop our culture really early on, and really start to like stake our claim and what makes us different as a studio. So one of those values that we have is no douchebags. And that was actually inspired by a book I was reading called The Culture Code by Daniel Coyle. And in that, he details a number of different cultural learnings from various really successful organizations. And one of them is the New Zealand All Blacks, which is like a rugby team. And they very famously have a rule in their organization, which is no dickheads. So I don't know if you'll bleep that out or how it works on the podcast.
Nope.
Cool.
Not anymore.
Perfect. I'm glad I'm the American who's bringing some profanity into this lovely little podcast.
Yes, you're very welcome. Please go right in.
Right. So they have this rule, and it's no dickheads. And it basically means, like, it's so absolutely clear what it's telling people. And, you know, I don't need to go into, like, all of the qualities of what a dickhead is. But the other thing about it that makes it work really well is that just that phrase itself is really arresting. It's like, if you're reading that, you know, it's one thing to say in your culture code, we don't like jerks, and people will be like, okay, whatever. But, you know, just the words, you know, no dickheads, like, people pay attention to that. So I wanted to have something that was similar to that, but maybe a little less visually graphic in a certain way. But basically got over like the same concept, because I think it's really important, and it works even better than something like maybe stay humble. So yep. Maybe we'll like one day we'll be selling, you know, Roamer, or we'll be going public, and, you know, our board will say like, okay, you have to change this to make it a little less profane, and we'll have to change it to like stay humble or something. But in the meantime, we're going to have to, we keep it with this. And it means that we don't want to be one of those gaming companies that's just full of people that are like, you know, really egotistical and self-entitled and, are uncompromising when it comes to the communication with other people. Like, you see this problem when folks are hiring, that they're always hiring rock stars, or there's like this period where everybody wanted to hire a rock star or a ninja or something like this. And what that basically meant was, we're going to pay a lot of money for somebody who is pretty good at their job, but they're going to be a horrible personality, and it's going to make a toxic workplace, and everybody's going to get like upset and hate working there and start quitting, and it's going to ruin everything you've built. And I wanted to nip that in the bud very early on. And I don't need to go into like all of the different gaming studios where you see this failing, and people, you know, definitely have douchebags. But the if you open up any like industry rag, you'll see at least, you know, once a week some report of like either a lawsuit that's getting fired, or, you know, something along these lines. And I think it's hugely a part of industry culture and studio culture. And that's something that we wanted to avoid with this line, no douchebags. And so we make sure that, you know, we're nipping it in the bud anytime we see it here at our own studio. Because like, people have tendencies, you know, and left unchecked, you know, because we're all human. Everybody has a bad day, and that's understandable. But like, left unchecked, it becomes negative culture. So you just have to kind of like stop it before that becomes a problem. You know, if somebody's not treating somebody else right, or not communicating properly, or like acting this way or the other, if you call it out, you can make sure you're working on it and rectify it early.
Yeah, yeah. Gotta pull those weeds out of the garden. Yeah. Good. Okay. Absolutely. Well, I have many questions about this, but I don't think we will have too much time. So, Florian, do you have a last question before we move on to our essential questions?
I don't know how short you can explain this, because we cannot really open up a huge new topic. But one thing I was wondering that we can spend another 5 minutes on is, so you are starting a studio at a moment in time where a lot of people, obviously, I mean, a lot of people at the time, or every time, always start their own companies. But at this specific moment in time, when new companies get founded, game studios, whatever, like, I'm surprised that you are not coming with this, oh, it's going to be a Web3 crypto, yada, yada, yada company. So when we talked about this and I was asking you, what's your plan? You said, we are specifically not that. And so I want to highlight that, because whenever I talk, and I talk to a lot of people starting their own companies, I often get this, oh yeah, we are doing this Web3 thingy, yada, yada, yada. Fine, do that. Why are you not?
That's a good question. When we were starting, we definitely asked ourselves if we wanted to pivot or include some sort of like a Web3 element. And for people who aren't super familiar with it, basically Web3 and blockchain or crypto or NFTs, they're all kind of in this intersection of this like tech concept, which is play to earn or play to own. And there's, again, a bunch of nuances there between all of them, but essentially all of them are saying like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if there was a distributed ledger that kept track of all of the items or currencies in a game, and those could be bought and sold for either normal currency, like fiat currency, like dollars or euros, or for cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin or Ethereum. And then players could play the game and they could earn those currencies and they could resell them, or they could earn special items like, you know, special swords or special badges, and they could resell them, reuse them, or blah, 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 blah. There is a myriad of different ways that all of those things can be implemented in games. We, being Roamer, are like not equipped currently to tackle that world. I think it's interesting. I think there's probably going to be some really great games that come from this. And the VC world right now is generally very, optimistic about these types of games. And there are some games that seem to be doing pretty well, like Sandbox. But we're not nearly experts. And I think a big part of it is that we wanted to be true to ourselves, and understand what our limits are. And just like we're not going down the route of creating like massive strategy games, then we're not, really in the position to be like making Web3 games. Cause like, you know, I don't even have like a crypto wallet. I'm probably like the worst person to make a game about it.
Nice. Which again, also just underlines to finish this up, like, why I believe you will have a successful company, because you know exactly what you're doing.
That's, very optimistic. I hope you are right. Thank you for that generous statement.
It certainly sounds like it. And to round it up, we like to ask some essential questions. And they're kind of like quick fire questions. And we got to keep it a bit quick fire today, because we are a bit out of time. I hope that's fine. I will start, and then Florian has some for you in the end. Are you ready for some essential quick fire questions?
I'm ready.
All righty. First question. What inspires you?
I am inspired by art and history and my wife. Was that the level of quick that I should do? Okay.
What is the purpose of your being?
The purpose of my being is to bring entertainment and joy to as many people as possible.
Nice. What is a beautiful day to you?
A beautiful day for me is waking up a little late, getting some delicious breakfast, probably waffles, and going outside, ideally surfing if I can, if I'm in that kind of place, or just to a cool park, and maybe playing a few video games, and then grabbing some beers with some friends.
No work in there, I see.
Well, you know. Beers can be work.
Surfing can be work.
Surfing can be work. And of course, working heads down for many hours on my startup.
Yeah, of course. That's what they all say. Okay, nice. What is the change you want to see in the world?
I would like to see people happier, relax a little bit, maybe be a bit kinder to each other, and kinder to themselves and kinder to the environment, which is like a really big ask. But all of those things would be really nice. I think people could stand to like slow down a little bit and maybe appreciate like all of the things that we have as like a society, and how far we've come.
And how do you contribute to that change you would like to see?
I contribute by making games for devices that won't that will fill landfills for a millennia. I contribute by making games that at least help people relax and connect with others, and find some peace and happiness and fun.
Awesome. Oh, it's so funny. A little bit of a different gear. If you would start a new save game in your life right now, or like a new game plus, what occupation would your new character have?
So if I just had to do a new save game, I would just do the thing I'm already doing. If I had to do a variation, if I wanted to stay in the same industry, then I would definitely go back and learn a whole lot more when it came to either programming or some art stuff, either as like a 3D modeler or something. But if you're like, no, Nate, you need to pick something that is not gaming, then I guess I would look into being something like a doctor or something that is like very different, but also very helpful. You can give back and learn a lot. I guess, yeah, maybe like a surgeon or something, like a trauma surgeon. That would be cool.
Nice. Cool. Being a game maker and doctor, like equal levels of giving back to society in my book.
Agreed. 100% agreed. You're welcome is what I have to say. You're welcome.
I know you read a lot. Do you have books that you often recommend or that you like to gift to people? You can say 1, 2, or 3.
Sure. There are certain books that I'm super, super into, and I'll reference all the time. From a business perspective, The Lean Startup by Eric Ries is probably the most important book that I think that anybody can read, in the startup world, which is a great way to just understand how to make startups work. I'm a huge reader of history. I really like history. So I would say, either 1491, which is about, the Americas before Columbus arrived, or maybe Prisoners of Geography, which is just about how all of like societies develop, according to, and like geopolitics is maybe defined by certain geographic needs. Like if you're in a place with, you know, a lot of water, then, you know, maybe you're a society that grows up and, you know, it's kind of like a trading society or exploration or blah, blah, blah. But it's like really interesting from history and politics. And then the last one I would recommend would be Flatland, which is a book about, it's sort of like a sci-fi book before there was like really, sci-fi. It's by an author named Edwin Abbott. And the premise of it is that there's a, it's kind of math. The present premise is that there is a, circle, or I think it's a square. He's a square and he wakes up and, he is introduced to the concept of other dimensions. So he's 2D. He's like on a piece of paper. Yeah. And he finds out that there's like this world that's like, you know, people on a society on a line, and there's like all these dots on a line, and they have like a kingdom. And then he meets a being that is merely a point that exists in space. There's no dimension to him. And then he also like goes and he journeys and he finds like a 3D world. And he has to like try and wrap his head around what it means to be 3D. And I think it's just like a good way to sort of like, it's like a real like entry level kind of like philosophy of like, what are the things we know and we understand and things we don't know, but we have to like understand that we don't know them. It's a cool book.
Very fun. Cool. Short title here. A Mathematical, Satirical, and Religious Allegory by Edwin A. Abbott. Never heard of it. Or maybe like from the corner of my eye. So nice reco. Thank you very much.
Nice. Now we get over to some more, which is the first one. What are your favorite games? Same kind of question. Also 1, 2, 3.
Sure. My favorite game on mobile right now is probably Polytopia, because it's like a cool strategy game.
What's that called again?
Polytopia.
Oh, Polytopia.
Yep. Also on PC, I would go with Civilization 6. And I'm playing a lot of a game called Timberborn right now, which is a new indie game by some Polish developers, which is the premise is like humanity has like, I don't know, died off. People have died, and the next creatures that have inherited the earth are beavers, and you need to build like, beaver cities. Nice. And it's completely absurd, but I'm really into. And if I'll throw in a fourth, I'll throw in Space Haven, which is a really cool game, another indie game where you're running like a, it's like a roguelike where you're trying to build a spaceship as you're flying around space and collecting resources and battling pirates and space aliens. And it's just a lot of fun. It's like got a lot of crafting in it. It's really difficult, but it's really cool.
Nice selection. Who is somebody from the games industry who you would like to get to know?
I'd love to meet Sid Meier, the creator of the Civilization series, as well as Sid Meier's Pirates and some other games, or Will Wright, who is the creator of The Sims and SimCity and a bunch of other really cool games, just so I can like try and absorb some of their brilliance.
Nice. So, so the challenge for us at this point, which we don't tell our guests ahead, so they don't like choose some easy stuff, is that we will try to connect you somehow, because the reason of this whole project GamesNet Berlin Europe is connecting people. So I cannot promise when this will happen, but at some point, I will try to introduce you to these people.
I would love that.
That's my new challenge now.
Thank you.
Who is someone you know who you think we should have on this podcast?
I think right here in Berlin, there's a great studio called Just Play. Its CEO is a gentleman named Carl Livy. He is super cool. I knew him when he was at AppLovin, really smart guy. And he started his own super successful studio that is specializing in games that have like a sort of a social good component. So he's giving back to the world as well, and would make a great guest. But probably more giving back a little bit more than I am, because I think he actually has like a charitable contribution sort of thing going on in his games. He'd be a good guy to have on here.
Cool. And where can people find you online, like contact you, read about you?
For our studio, we have roamergames.com. And if I'm not on there, I am also on LinkedIn. You can just add me, Nathaniel Barker. Just be sure to like include that you heard me in the podcast, and then I'll kind of know who the person is. It'd be helpful. Nice. It's probably the best place to find me. Yeah.
Return on advertisement spend. Yeah. Explained one more time.
One more time. I'll do it every time you ask. I'm happy. I'm happy to do it.
No, I mean by asking people that they heard you here. That's like how you know that your advertisement here.
Ah, yes, that's the LinkedIn message you have to give. It's like, please explain return on ad spend in your LinkedIn request, and I will gladly get back to you, proving that.
That's the code to enter when you add me. No, I'm generally pretty nice. I just add me, and I'm happy to talk anytime with anybody who wants to talk about games.
Perfect. Cool. I have to run. Thank you very, very much for being on. It was super interesting. I think I could talk hours longer with you and probably, hopefully, will sometime soon.
Yeah, likewise. Florian, Simon, this was like a real pleasure. And I'm really honored that you invited me onto the show. You know, I hope it was nice and informative for your listeners. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Have a good one. See you soon. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Hi there, Simon here. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you like what you hear here and you would like to hear more here, feel free to follow or to subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you get your audio fix. We appreciate you and we promise you to bring you many more insightful conversations with fantastic games industry guests from Berlin and from all over Europe. Thank you very much and see you very soon. Bye bye.
Hi there. Before you go, this is Florian, project manager for GamesNet Berlin Europe. If you want to stay connected to the network, find out more about upcoming events and links to other MediaNet initiatives, you can visit us at gamesnetberlin.eu and subscribe to our newsletter. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast, and until next time.